You're listening to Beyond Busy, the show where we talk productivity, work-life balance, and defining happiness and success. All the big questions for work and life. My name's Graham Alcott. I'm your host for the show. And on this episode, I'm talking to Fred Pellard. Fred is the author of a book called How to Be Strategic. He is a former rocket scientist and also strategic consultant to some of the biggest brands in the world. Nike, Barclays, Ernst & Young, The Guardian, Tate, Sky, IKEA, the list goes on. So before we get into that episode, just a quick reminder that the tickets are on sale for my 6 weeks to Ninja evening class. It's UK time, Thursday evenings, 6 weeks during November and December. And if you want to find out more about that, just go to grahamalcott.com. We'll put a link in the show notes as well at getbeyondbusy.com. But I'd love you to come along, basically. It's a small group. The idea is that we will be going through some of the key chapters and therefore habits of my book, How to Be a Productivity Ninja, all the stuff that you need to get organized ready for the new year, all the stuff that you need to kick your productivity into shape. So if you want to be part of that, 6 weeks to Ninja, it's the first time I've done it. It's basically taking all the stuff from my one day masterclass and putting it in an evening format. I'm really excited about doing it in this new format. And it's called 6 weeks to Ninja. So it's on Eventbrite if you want to just search it on there, and also just at grahamalcott.com. I'd love you to check it out. Right, let's get into the episode, recorded as they all are these days. I used to really love doing them face to face, and now they are all down the line, sadly. But recorded just a couple of weeks ago, here is my conversation with Fred Pellard. Fred Pellard, how are you doing?
Very well, Graham. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm quite amused by the fact that you just had told me that, like, your preparation for this conversation was listening to Beyond Busy, and I was the soundtrack to your journey through Kent. I don't think I've ever been described as that before. So that's an amusing start.
My pleasure. It was, you know, and also it was the first trip after the end of lockdown this year. So you were absolutely a sign of freedom.
Oh, I'm a sign of freedom. Oh, that's made me happy at 5 o'clock on a Tuesday afternoon. So we're going to talk about your book, How to Be Strategic, and talk strategy. And this has been, before you wrote the book, obviously a big part of your life's work, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's one of these sort of 15 years of experience shoehorned into 200 pages.
So you were a management consultant and you worked for Calchas and the Instigate Group, and with a lot of people who've worked for McKinsey and Bain and the kind of consultancies that people would know about. What would you say, if someone doesn't know that world, how would you describe the life of a management consultant?
So the life of a management consultant or a strat consultant is long hours, huge amount of structure, and extraordinarily varied. So one of the differences between sort of these careers and more corporate-y or even tech startup is when you work in consulting, every 3 months you have to enter an entirely new world and find a way to fit in. So you're going to tackle completely new problem. In particular, as it were, there's two strands of consulting, and that's why I was kind of mentioned. There's management consulting and strat consulting. And management consulting is very much about telling companies how to do things, and usually it comes from a place of expertise. And then strat consulting is more working out with companies what else they might be doing, and it comes more from a place of sort of analysis and discovery.
Yeah.
And so management consultants tend to be a bit more senior and a bit more sort of prescriptive, whereas strat consultants are a bit more sort of junior and discovery, you know, discover things. And both of these involve long hours and intellectual stimulation.
And when I've worked with consultants as well, I mean, just the sort of geographical spread of it, you know, so I'm just going to live in Reading for 3 months and then I'm going to be in Edinburgh, and, you know, just that whole sense of kind of often being placed in, you know, faraway places in hotels and that kind of stuff. Is that an experience that you can relate to? Was that a big part of your own career?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I've been in Britain for 20 years. I'm now sort of a British citizen as well as a French citizen. And the first 5 years in Britain, I'm so grateful that I got to spend time in, you know, Rotherham and Doncaster and Grimsby and really get to experience the reality of a country. Absolutely.
There's probably like a sort of George Orwell book or something in that, you know, the Frenchman in Grimsby or something, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Just feels like an incongruous thing. So you mentioned there before this idea of walking into a new workplace, a new organization, a new building, a new culture, and having to try and work out how they do things and having to try and fit in and be part of that culture. Were there any particular examples of organizations that the culture was just particularly striking, or where it went wrong, or like just what were some of the sort of more extreme experiences of culture that you've had over the years?
Well, some of the things you might say is, you know, a consultant who works into organization is a foreign body trying to integrate. And if they integrate well, they can get the organizations to go in certain ways. If they don't, they're on the outside. And so you spend a lot of time really looking for the clues, the codes, and you might notice things that even some of the employees in these organizations don't notice. So, for example, over the years, I've done quite a bit of work, more as a trainer than a consultant, to be fair. So I've been a consultant for 10 years, and I've been a trainer for the last 15. And as a trainer, you get a little bit closer to organization. Very simply put, a consultant is someone whose company has been hired by your company to help improve things. A trainer is someone who is in the room to help you become smarter. So there's more of a, you know, personal connection. And as a trainer, for example, I work a lot with broadcasters in the UK. So I work with BBC, ITV, Sky, and Channel 4. And then when you work across all, you notice some interesting things. So for example, you know, about sort of timekeeping. There is an element where we're talking about productivity. In some organizations, let's say hypothetically Sky, there's a really strong element of, you know, we're going to deliver, we're going to be productive, we're going to be organized, we're going to be structured. So if a meeting is on the hour, then you show up, you know, 5 minutes before. At the, you know, somewhere in the middle, sort of ITV, the hour is the hour. Channel 4 is a bit more, well, you know, if you show up at the meeting within 5 minutes after it has started, you're still on time. And then at the BBC, there's usually a tendency to you know, juggle many, many balls, actually handle a lot of different stakeholders. As you know, you've got to please, you know, certain constituencies, you've got to be careful about, be mindful of some of the press, etc. And so lots of people juggling lots of things. If you show up at the meeting within the first 15 minutes, you're still considered on time, for example.
Right.
And that's a,
right.
And after a while, you kind of go, okay, that's an interesting, that's a sort of cultural norm. And you know that if one were to take a jump with these organizations, then, you know, you go with the cultural norm.
Have you watched the sitcom W1A, which is like a spoof of the BBC?
Absolutely. And just as I was telling you, I was about to say, one has to be a little bit careful about over sort of deriding some of it. Because at the other end, now talking about other organizations, sometimes extreme productivity, as you know, can lead to massive problems. Because as we've seen, for example, with supply chains during the pandemic, when you optimize everything within an inch of its life, then all of a sudden, when a couple of people get sick, then the whole organization falls down. So there's a little bit where, in particular, quite commonly, the more creative someone is, the less productive they're going to be, and vice versa, according to the classic metrics of productivity. There was a great, I forget his name now, but the writer of The West Wing, Aaron Sorkin, you know, has a great comment, which is, he goes, "I have all my best ideas in the shower." And taking a slightly productivist take on that, he goes, well, if all my best ideas are in the shower, he actually installed a shower in his office. and every time he was stuck for ideas, he'd have a shower. And one of the things he realized is, actually, by the time you productivize the hell out of the shower moment, it's no longer serendipitous and an early morning or late evening endeavor, and you get less out of each additional shower.
But I think ideas come often in the places that you least expect them, because that's where there's space, right? And so, you know, certainly for me, if I've had a really difficult long day and I know there's another 15 things to do on emails and everything else. Often the best thing, and I don't always stick to this, but the best thing is just to get outside and go for a walk for half an hour, because often just that process of sort of clearing your head and being outside of your desk and your work is often the place where your brain figures it all out, right?
Well, that's absolutely, absolutely. And in particular, the approach that you describe is one that companies slightly underplay. Because if I talk about sort of one really well-known model that I put in sort of how to be strategic is the different ways by which people learn and the different ways by which they solve problems. And so if you think about, you know, it can be a bit derided, but NLP identify the fact some people are very visual, so they see stuff. Some people are auditory, they hear it and talk. And some people are more digital and some people are more kinesthetic. So what you describe typically would be described as kinesthetic. So people who need the sort of the physical activity to stimulate the brain. I know quite a few people, in particular people who work in strength consulting, where when you force them to go and walk to think, their brain freezes because they get lots of stimulation and input from the body, which doesn't help with problem solving.
Okay.
And so the bit that I would say here is what you describe, for example, is one type of idea generation, which is what I would refer to as sort of the serendipitous, which is, you know, let me bring from the nether regions of my recesses brain, poof, a flash of insight. And then typically the thing that I tend to help people with more is at the other end of the spectrum, which is the idea of like, how can you create what I would call structured brainstorm?
Yeah.
And so if you think of the three sort of completely, you know, serendipitous, which is the one you described, you know, go for a walk and hope for the idea to land on you. A more traditional one is in a office environment, 10 people get together to solve a problem. And typically the classic technique they will use is to brainstorm, whether they use, you know, post-it notes or just verbal language, but they'll kind of each contribute. And what I tend to help people with is slightly more structured brainstorm technique, which really means sort of take the time to create some booster rockets under the first five ideas you'll have. So most people's brainstorm stops after five ideas. You know, if I ask you sort of, you know, which restaurants, well, we could go there. By five, you go, I've got a long list now, I'm done. Mm. And usually the first five solutions can be the ones that are sort of top of mind. And then it's helpful as a team, for example, as a large group, to create an environment in which you will get past the first five to discover a few more.
And there's a thing that you wrote in the book which really resonated with me. So you basically say being strategic is a skill and you can learn it. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's often thought of as being like a character trait. And it's often thought of as being, you know, most people's experience of strategy is that once a year or so, they're taken to a hotel somewhere and they do some strategy. But actually thinking about it more as a skill and thinking about it more as something that you can inherently apply and use in all of your decisions and kind of day to day, I think it is just much more compelling. So if someone's listening to this, I think there'll be a lot of people listening to this who don't necessarily feel like they are strategic people or feel like they could have more strategic thinking. So how can people learn it? Like what are some of the key ways that you can just get better at being a strategic thinker?
Okay. I love the dichotomy or the comparison you've made between sort of strategy and strategic. And a lot of people's experience of strategic is actually strategy, which is, you know, the big decision done once a year of the organization, as you say, in that hotel. Or if I make an analogy with, you know, people traveling to see some friends, the strategy is who you're going to go and see and what weekend. There you go, boom. And so it's done once for the trip. The strategic is at various points asking yourself, actually, should we continue on the motorway? Would be better off taking a smaller, you know, a better, more touristic-y journey with more sites? Or should we stop at this petrol station or at the next one because it has slightly better food? And so what you find is the strategy tends to be the end destination that you spend a long time thinking, but once it's set, it's set. Mm. And the strategic is the question you might ask yourself at various points in time to ensure that you achieve your outcome. And one of the reasons people are a bit uncomfortable around strategic is because of the infrequent nature of strategy. If there's a skill that you use once, I mean, you know it. If I go into the kitchen or the work cabinet, if you're in the kitchen and you open your cutlery drawer, you look at a spoon, you look at a fork, you look at a knife, you know how to use it without a problem. And then there'll be some slightly bizarre utensil, probably in the second drawer, when you go, oh, how do we use that again?
I've got a couple of those.
But there you go. Because that may be the ones you use once a year for the turkey at Christmas or, you know, I don't know, an egg shaver for Christmas. And every time you look at it, you go, oh, how does it work? And one of the issues with strategic is it is a skill. The more you practice it, the better you're at it. And it's a slightly, it's quite at odds with the most classic way by which people solve problem every day. If you give me sort of another minute here, I'll expand a bit and I'll say there's four main ways to solve problems, the expert way, the analytical way, the creative way, and the strategic way. And most of us spend most of our days in the expert mode. In other words, when we're trying to solve a problem, most of the problems we solve every day are problems for which we already have the answer. And by the way, that's lucky because it's good for one's sanity, and it's also good for one's income because you get paid for the stuff you're good at doing. Mm-hmm. Your CV or your LinkedIn page is effectively a manifestation to the outside world of the stuff you're good at solving.
Yeah.
And then every so often, by the way, there's quite a few professions, I don't know, personal trainers, police officer, estate agents who spend most of the day exactly in that mode. They have a body of information that's not available to their counterpart, and therefore, at every hour of the day, they're the expert. They're either the law, literally for police officers, or they are the most knowledgeable about the market for estate agents, etc. The second way to solve problem, which is the analytical mode, is one where it's, you know, what if the problem has never been tackled before? And we've seen a lot of that around COVID. You know, how do we work? What is my job going to look like? How do I make the organization work? How is the country going to keep everyone safe? You know, how is the government going to help keep people safe? And usually at that point, there's a tendency for people to default to the analytical approach, which is to say, there's lots of information that I'm missing. Let me go and gather all the facts, and then I'll see the solution emerge. Professions like, you know, lawyers, investigative journalists, engineers, specialist doctors spend their days doing that, being very analytical. And by the way, you or me might do that when we're looking at buying a new car. You know, we'll spend a lot of research, we'll go and visit, etc. And that's a great way to solve problem. Slight drawback is, if you can hear all of these, a lot of analytics is not a great way to invent the future. And then the third way to solve problem is the creative one that goes, let me not worry too much about things I don't know. Let's invent a number of solutions. And you think about, you know, whether it's designers or advertising creatives or even sometimes military officers or your GP, many of these people will really quickly come up with a range of options to a particular problem rather than worry about gathering too much data right away. And if I put these in front of you, they'd literally be, you know, if you think about the matrix and the blue pill and the red pill, what I've showed in front of you here is sort of, you know, the left path, the middle path, and the right path. The one ahead is the expert. The one on the analytical is, I refer to it as the submarine of analytical research, is the one where you spend more time, you go underwater, you disappear for a while, you gather lots of information, and then maybe at the end there's a sort of a missile that appears with the solution. And then the creative one I refer to as the helicopter of creative discovery, where you take off from the ground, you explore your surroundings, and you come up with a wide array of ideas right away. And when you think about these three, you probably, usually when I describe them like that, people go, oh, the first one is my dad, the second's my brother, and you know, and my brother's girlfriend is very much so. We can quite easily recognize more than just, you know, archetypes. We can recognize friends and family and colleagues in these three descriptions of the expert, the analytical, and the creative. And then the fourth one, very few people recognize because it's a slightly less visible skill. Because if you think about what is a strategic person, a strategic or strategic mindset. Let me be a bit careful, because when I call someone creative, it's usually someone who spends most of their day solving problem in a creative fashion. An analytical person will spend most of their days solving problem in an analytical fashion. Think of these as like cutlery, you know, the fork, the knife, the spoon. Some people have a strong preference for one, but we will borrow from each of these utensils in the right circumstances. And now the strategic one, and sorry, here's a slight long preamble, but it goes, the strategic one, most people are a bit anxious, and then usually it clicks in the next 30 seconds, because the way I explain it is I go, if something is strategic, it's in the future. If it's in the future, no data is really reliable. Again, think about, you know, March 2020, when we're looking at what happens with our societies under COVID. So if it's in the future, if you're strategic, you're looking at the future. If it's in the future, the first thing you got to do is be creative.
Yeah.
And then you come up with a range of possible solutions. And typically the difference between a creative and a strategic, creative is often a subjective choice as to which solution you're going to go with, what, you know, which way you're going to redo your kitchen, what clothes you're going to wear today. All of these, you can have lots of ideas. And then how do you decide on one? Subjectively, either intuitively right away or over time by mulling things over. If it's a strategic issue, once you've had all the options, you're going to tell yourself, look, I need to absolutely be objective in the choice of what is the approach that minimizes the number of deaths in society? What is the approach that minimizes the impact on all our jobs and on GDP? What's the option that combines these two? And to be ruthlessly objective, you now have to sort of take your creativity and combine it with a very, very analytical approach where you kill a lot of you eliminate a lot of your ideas because they don't stack up.
And so that's where if you approach things creatively and you end up, you know, let's say you have particular biases that you can't see or particular kind of pet ideas that were yours and you think are really great, it can be really easy to just follow those through. And then, you know, that's where by sort of stress testing it and analyzing it, you really, you know, come to look at these things more objectively rather than just kind of hanging on to the bits that were more memorable or made more sense to you.
Absolutely. And one of the, by the way, apologies, sometimes I can talk for a few minutes at a time, as you know.
That's okay.
I earn a living.
I knew there were floor traits, so I was just leaving you to get through the floor.
Thank you very much. And also the drawback is, you know, earning a living as a public speaker, sometimes there's a tendency to go, and now let me tell you the 27 anecdotes. So
apologies. And on my next slide.
Yes, exactly. Apologies for that.
The next slide I was going to ask you about is this slide of the roller coaster of strategic thinking, because I think that leads on quite nicely. So tell us about that roller coaster. And presumably this is a process that you're going through with clients.
Absolutely.
Like that's kind of like almost the way that you would structure a strategic process with
clients,
right?
And that's one of the things. So if you know, we're all familiar with what a roller coaster looks like, but imagine a very simple roller coaster. So it goes up, down and back up again. And in that little simple shape, you've got the shape of that strategic problem solving takes all the time. The best way to solve problem is, you know, strategic equals creative plus analytical, and being creative first, analytical second. So the creative bit, if it was on a roller coaster, is go up with your energy, with your enthusiasm, with some structured thinking, and come up with lots of possible options. And then the bit that differentiates a pure creative person, as you alluded to, sometimes people are very creative, have a tendency maybe to fall in love with their ideas. And a strategic person has a slightly bizarre click, which is at the top of the roller coaster, they switch mindset and now they go, I don't really care which of my seven ideas turns out to be the best. What I want is I wait until the downward part of the roller coaster, find out which of these seven is the one that's the winner, and that's the one I'll back.
Yeah.
And in that contrast, you know, with the sort of the roller coaster of being, it's a roller coaster of both creativity and also it's an intellectual roller coaster and an emotional roller coaster. And for example, that image is a fantastic way to make sense of people like Steve Jobs or Jeff Bezos. You know, every anecdote about Steve Jobs talked about how extraordinary visionary he was and how sort of painful as a human being it was to work with, whether as family or colleagues or boss. And when you realize that, I mean, nobody would have called Steve Jobs anything other than strategic. And one of the things that he did very naturally is get super enthusiastic around some ideas. And then once they were, okay, let's make that happen, then be ruthless at sort of testing them nearly by destruction. And that ability to go from I love it to I hate it is sometimes giving yourself a bit of whiplash, because you have to go through, let's come up with three, four, five possible solutions. And then pose. What I do is I don't drink coffee, I only drink tea, which is how I got the passport. And so, you're going to make a cup of tea. And then when you come back, you know, sometimes you role play a slightly meaner version of yourself that rolls its eyes at the collection of ideas that your previous self came up with.
You must have come across Edward de Bono's work, right?
And absolutely.
The six thinking hats, and just the idea of taking an idea and then looking at it almost like with different lenses. And, you know, let's look at the resource part of this. Let's think about the negative aspects of this and, you know, potential things that we've not spotted. And I think sometimes we can make big decisions, but we don't do that kind of thinking often enough when we're making some of those decisions, right?
Yes. And part of the issue is, if you think about, you know, six thinking hats, I think if either of us challenged each other to name the six, we know the technique, yeah. We know the color of the hats, but I couldn't of the tip of my tongue list the six. That's because six feels like a slight overkill. And here is the comment, when I talk about the roller coaster, really, I go, there's like three stages, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
And I literally call them up, down, push. So first be very positive, then go very negative, and then really push the thing that you're left with. And actually, interestingly enough, if you want to take it into a more Milne environment, you can recognize Winnie the Pooh, where, you know, you go Tigger first, Eeyore second, and Winnie third. So first be super enthusiastic, then be very critical, then be practical.
That's cool. So you get to, so wherever you are listening to this, you can channel your inner Eeyore or Tigger, like depending on which part of the process you're in.
And rebounding on that, one of the tips, you know, we talk about sort of there's the roller coaster, then there's 12 techniques that people apply in practice, and at the end there's kind of a few tips. And one of the tips I would make is that is not in there, let me call it tip six, is you have to be Tigger before you're Eeyore. And that's really, really important, because whether people are looking, for example, in current situation, if you tell yourself that you need more information before you decide, the future is so uncertain that you're going to trap yourself into a vortex of sort of Eeyore-ishness. And so the way to be strategic is to go, I don't know enough, that's true, but let me invent three or four possible solutions. You know, I could work from home, I could do that, I could change up, I could do X, Y, Z. And then once you've laid them out, then you go, what's wrong? What's the good and bad with each of these? And you'll find that you get a bit further. And then typically linked with that, sometimes you might not do it on your own. You might do it at work with a few colleagues. One of my tip is small teams go up and large teams go down. So if you're going to try and be optimistic and positive and find a way, you're probably better off with a small group of people, three or four, not more. And if you're trying to eliminate an idea, because effectively in a small group, you can create an illusion as a team that you'll find a way. You know, the army use rangers or if you look at sort of people go ahead and explore the path, they're usually very, very small team because it's discreet, it's quick, it's nimble. And then when you have these ideas, then what you want is a large body of people. You really want then the person who's going to tell you why it's wrong, and you needed that very narrow expertise that they have that kind of help dampen an idea. So small teams go up and large teams go down.
Love that. I wanted to talk to you about the happiness line, partly because we're on Beyond Busy and we talk a lot on this podcast about not just productivity, but also how people define happiness and success. And the happiness line in the book, I think, people listening to this are going to have to go and get the book to find out some more, because I think a lot of it is it's a very visual sort of graphic representation. But I just love the sort of the idea of the tension, like the sort of happy tension thing that you talk about. So do you want to just explain where that comes from and what it is?
With pleasure. Yes, indeed. So the happy life is a construct. So there is a strategy professor who teaches at INSEAD called Chan Kim, who came up with a book called Blue Ocean Strategy, which has been a phenomenal success. Chan Kim is, if you're in the rarefied world of strategy and strategy consulting, is one of the rock stars. And the format before Blue Ocean Strategy was something called the happy line. And the two are slightly different. Blue Ocean Strategy is about how you completely invent new worlds, hence the blue ocean, you know, blue, a completely sort of open-ended corner. The happy line is a bit more, how do you make the best out of the circumstances you find yourself in? And if I make an analogy, the happy line is a fantastic way to help, is a structured thinking technique to help improve a relationship. Because it says the key to success, the key to productivity, the key to everything, Chan Kim introduces the notion that there's another party. You're doing it not just for you. There's someone else involved. So to be successful in business, you've got to have a client that's happy. You've got to have employees that are happy. You've got to have regulators that are happy. And what he suggests, it's, if I use a more well-known sort of popular say, is there's, you know, the golden rule is treat others as you would like to be treated. And Chan Kim introduces this idea that actually it's a good rule, but there's a better rule. Is the better rule is treat others as they would like to be treated.
Right.
Because everyone has subjective preferences. And so, for example, for many people who are looking, you know, some people might have difficulties in a career or in a relationship, or the example I often find, because they often use, is parents. You go, you know what? There might be, out of your two parents, there might be one you get along with real easily and another one it's a bit harder. Likewise, you know, your boss, you might have a certain relationship, or some clients. And what Chan Kim posits with the happy line is, if you create a two-dimensional picture, and it's hard to explain it like this, but it goes on the horizontal axis, plot the criteria that matter to the other person, and preferably in decreasing order. And then on the vertical axis, you plot how well you're doing on these dimensions. So, you know, if it's your boss that you want to please, you go, what's important to my boss? And some of you would have a boss for whom the most important thing is, you know, on-time delivery, then it would be accuracy, then would be, I don't know, foreign languages, then would be making tea. For other people, you might have a boss who values, you know, emotional intelligence above everything, and then creativity, and then on-time is a much less important criteria. And so what you've identified here on that horizontal axis is the relative importance of what Chan Kim calls purchasing criteria, the relative importance of aspects of performance to the other person. And effectively, your performance at work is a subjective activity where someone else decides whether you're doing well or not. And what many people do is they don't put themselves in the shoes of the other party in trying to satisfy someone. And you might be giving them more and more and more of stuff they don't really care about, rather than a little bit of what they really care.
That's so true, isn't it? Because often you'll just think about it more from the point of view of, here's the thing that I care about and I'm doing a good job with it, so therefore I'm succeeding.
Yes, and you're right. There's you know, and I can see it myself too. There's a virtuous circle. Is if there's something you're good at, usually you find it's pretty important to you, so you do more of it, which is why you get good at, which you value even more. And you can sometimes get trapped into doing more and more whilst getting less. I mean, if I bring it to a very simple scenario that everyone will be, you know, listening will be familiar, is when you're a romantic relationship, there's a tendency, how much thought do you put into the criteria of the other party when you make a present? Do you offer the other person what you would like to get, or do you offer them what they would like to get? And it takes and the beauty about the happy line and Chan Kim, and I would argue many of the techniques in the book, is they are the boundary between IQ and EQ. They are the boundary between sort of intelligence and emotional intelligence, because they make you think, okay, what would another stakeholder want, or what would be really important?
shout out to my best mate at uni, Gareth Parker, and on his birthday 1 year, I bought him the CD of Common's album, Like Water for Chocolate, just because I wanted it. And I had a mini disc player, so I could basically like record it onto mini disc and then it was done, right? So shout out to Gareth, and he knows I've changed since then.
I was about to say, it's big of you to interesting enough, I could reciprocate and sort of demonstrate humble bragging, because I can absolutely see that when my peers at INSEAD, a business school in France 20 bit years ago, when they found out that I was kind of explaining emotional intelligence technique, many of them laughed because I was I'm a French rocket scientist. And when they met me, I was probably slightly trapped in a narrow, very analytical, very mathematical view of the world. And we all grow.
Nice.
By listening to podcasts like yours.
So a couple of other things on strategy, then I'm going to talk to you about your own productivity and your own work-life balance too. So one of the sections that you talked about on that roller coaster is this idea of push. And so let's say you've come up with lots of ideas, you've tested them, you've got rid of some of them, and then you've committed to the ones that really matter. And then a really important part of that strategic process becomes how to sell those ideas to other people. And of course, this is something that even when you're not making a strategic decision, you know, we have to sell ideas to everybody all the time, right? And so in the book, you've got these three sort of elements to that. So through impactful words, simple numbers, and compelling stories. I wonder if you've just got any thoughts about just some simple techniques that people can take away around just how to sell ideas and how to persuade.
Yes. So the indeed. So you know, the shorthand is sort of words, numbers, and story. And if you think about the story, that the best structure, universally acknowledged to be the best way to structure a story, is something called the Pyramid Principle, where you create a series of post-its or notes where you go, you know, you've got one at the top, three below that, nine below that, 27, you follow a rhythm of three. And at the top, you go, this is the conclusion, this is what I'm recommending, or this is what I think we should do, either as an organization or myself, or... And then below that, literally, you go, the three reasons why that should be the case are X, Y, Z. And when you make the effort of writing the story that way, you'll be amazed at how you take something that's quite complicated. For example, you know, we have overcome the COVID pandemic. And then you go, okay, what would need to be true for that? Well, you know, because the virus is not circulating freely in the population at large anymore. And the economy has started again, and there's no risk of a third wave. Okay, well, you know that will be a pretty powerful message to deliver to Parliament, possibly around, you know, February or March next year. And then you go, now we've created the structure, and it's quite easy to remember the three bits. So not circulating anymore, GDP economy is back, and it's not going to happen again. And so when you take a story, usually follow it up or back it up through three components and replicate that. So you go from one to three to nine to 27.
So then, so taking that pyramid, so one of those is that the economy is working again. So then you would come up with like, what are the three reasons that the economy is working? It's like the service sector has improved and people are using shops again, you know, whatever those. So you base three things around each of those. Is that how that works essentially?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Nice. That's a cool little structure. I like it. I love the bit because you talk about the pyramid in the book where there's like the, if this is true and that is true, and you're kind of using threes in that same kind of way, right?
Yes. And I have the one exercise. So I'm veering up. It's in the book as well. But one of the things, you know, a lot of the techniques in the book I mentioned is like sort of, you know, 20 years or 15 years of training shoehorned into 200 pages. Mm-hmm. And one of the homework I usually give to people, and I tend to link strategic. So it's about strategic thinking. And I find that people learn the technique better if they can apply it to their own life. Because once you realize the kind of different solutions that strategic thinking bring to your day-to-day personal problem solving, it's very easy to make the leap and go, of course, it's going to work for my work environment. And so one of the things I recommend with a pyramid, for example, is you know, if you wanted to tell a story to yourself in a year's time, a lot of people today will ask themselves, you know, how is my life going to look like next year? Just that question, you could probably hear massively rises. You know, it makes anxiety go through the roof because you go, what's my life going to be like next year? What's my life going to be like? And that's one of the limitations of the analytical approach to problem solving in the future, because we don't have the answer for what your life's going to be. And what the pyramid principle, for example, suggests is, instead of focusing on the question, flip it into an answer and populate backwards. So what that means here is I get people to write on the wall, my life is a great success in 2022. Just writing it, and you can see already the anxiety goes down. So people start smiling. They go, oh, that's cool. I like that. And then I go, now, before we go into PR mode, let's actually be strategic and go, what would need to be true for that to be true? And literally, you go, well, if, you know, my job is there, or I find some kind of gainful employment, and everyone in my family has overcome the virus quite well, and then, you know, my mental health has gone through that unaffected, then my life is pretty good.
Yeah.
And by the way, please note, that might be a first draft where you go, you know, financial, family, mental health, and you might go, actually, let me reorder that. Let me start with family, then mental health, then financial. And you go, yeah, that's a story that meets better maybe my idea of priorities. And so there's some beautiful ways that way to connect sort of the power of strategic thinking in your day-to-day life, and then realizing that if on an issue that you know so well, which is, you know, how your life is going, a tiny technique that you borrow from outside can help give you clarity and loss of anxiety, then it's not too difficult to go, wow, if I apply a few more minutes and I brought in a few more colleagues to do the same thing with our, you know, either our team or our division or our company at work, then we're quite likely to achieve the same outcome.
I really feel like that's a neat segue into the other thing I wanted to ask you about in terms of the book. Is one of your five tips at the end is the third solution is often the best. Mm-hmm. And it sort of feels like there's this magic power of three, you know, three is the magic number. So tell us about why the third solution is often the best.
So this one, I can't quite explain it. It's one of these, you know, heuristic, which is a fancy word for I've been noticing it. It's a bit like the, you know, and so there's a little bit where, you know, maybe that's in a meeting when you have yings and yangs and Eeyores and Tiggers, and there's going to be someone who's going to plant a stake in the ground and go, boom, that would be a solution. Everyone rolls their eyes. And at the other end, someone goes, boom, no, really. And, you know, we should stay what we've been doing. And then the third one is often some sort of compromise. And then you might go, there might be a fourth and a fifth. And sometimes the fourth and the fifth are a little bit too crazy, a bit too fancy. And they usually play a good role. And then what you find is, you know, if it was sort of the Olympics, whether a swimming pool or you know, 100 meters, you'd let them run. And then you'd find that typically it's, you know, it's the middle lane that tends to arrive first.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a bit like that, where the third answer is often the best one.
Nice. It really reminds me of when I was in my first ever management job, and I was still a student at this point, and I worked for this bank, and they made us do this exercise. It was to gain a management position, and they made us do this exercise to test team working skills. Mm-hmm. And my supervisor at the time, who was really rooting for me, just took me to one side before I did it and said, and just gave me this really simple advice, which always stuck with me, which is like, okay, they're not looking for the leader at this point. They're looking for how you relate to others and how you work in a team. So everyone will just fly off the handle and start answering stuff. Just hang back and then just, you know, wait for the lull in the conversation. And then you present the sort of, you know, the compromise, the middle way, and kind of sum up what people have been discussing so far, because it shows that you're listening. It shows that you're not kind of hot-headed, sort of running in there trying to impress everybody or whatever. And like, it's the quietly confident, you know, person who hangs back that succeeds in this. And it's that kind of thing, isn't it? It's like the, you know, everyone's, you know, sort of pulled an idea this direction, that direction. And if you're just like somewhere in the middle, you're likely to kind of have more of an influence.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I love your approach. Very good.
Love it. So let's talk about a couple of other things outside of the book. You dropped this in a few minutes ago. I used to be a rocket scientist. So that's one of those things where obviously there's, you know, people have this saying that it's not rocket science. So tell me what rocket science is actually like.
Well, so I am a rocket scientist, but I'm also someone who's lived in Britain for 20 years. So I know it has social cachet here.
Yeah.
I promise you that in dinner parties in France, when you say I'm a rocket scientist, they go, yeah, whatever. Because there's two schools of rocket science. There's a rocket science industry. So the flip equivalent is if you tell people in France that you're in a band, they go, oh, wow.
Oh, really?
And in Britain, you're in the band. It's like, yeah, everyone is in a band, ain't it? And that's the same. That has the same sort of, you know, at the risk of being unfair on my fellow French citizens, you know, French music hasn't really taken on the world since probably the 16th century. And so, French music is a bit behind the times. And that's also because very few students are in a band. It's not a rite of passage. It's not something you do. In Britain, that's kind of like, oh, you went through university without being in a band. What was wrong with you?
Yeah,
and so
right, yeah.
Rocket science has a tiny bit of that particular bit. It's a sort of, I sometimes describe it as an extreme form of mathematical nerdiness.
Have you watched the documentary about Challenger that's on Netflix at the moment?
Oh, that's very much on my watch list.
Yeah. I won't spoil it, but I think you'll find it fascinating. And what I found really fascinating, because I was quite young when that happened, but I remember being at a McDonald's birthday party and then coming home and my mum telling me about it because it was going to be on the news. That, you know, all these people had watched this rocket go up and these people just basically be killed in midair, you know, and it was just this awful thing. And it's still kind of seared on my brain as being this, you know, maybe it might even be my first memory of there being a tragedy, because I still remember it really vividly. But it's a really interesting documentary. And I suppose what is interesting about it is that it's not really about rocket science or the Challenger at all. It's kind of about human error and how certain people under certain sort of moments of pressure make decisions that aren't great. So it's a really interesting watch, and I won't say any more than that, but definitely check it out if you haven't seen it on Netflix. When we were about to schedule this, we were going to do this conversation last week, and it was September here in the UK and it was really sunny. And you sent me a really lovely email that was like, Graham, the sun's out. Can we do this next week? And I just really liked it. So it's one of those things that I'm often tempted to do. And then for some reason, I never do it. So I wondered if you had learned how to sort of organize your work around work-life balance and simple pleasures like sitting in your garden and enjoying the sunshine.
Oh, very, very, very much so. And sort of it's even a joke among my friend, which is I'm sort of weather bureau. Because you know I'm a proper strategic thinker, which is I have indoor activities and outdoor activities. So typically, for example, inventing new stuff is best done indoors because it's a bit intense, etc. Seeping in new knowledge, I love doing it outdoors, and so I schedule things. And I know I have a tiny balcony. It's a really tiny balcony outside, but it faces south, and so in London, you know, whenever when sun's out, sort of, you know, I don't know, there's an expression that goes, when sun's out, guns out. And I should come up with something a bit similar with me. And now, if talking about productivity, I'm going to share something that some of you will hate me for, but I want to kind of mention it there. So I've been an entrepreneur, and at some point I had 20 employees working really hard. And then through various circumstances, I ended up working solo for the last 15 years. And then when I didn't have any employees anymore, I was a bit more in charge of my own diary. And I realized that in my line of work, to help people think better, you know, I usually describe myself as kind of like, I help smart people get smarter. And for that, I have to stay a step ahead, not necessarily in smartness, but at least in knowledge about smart sources. And so I have to read, I have to ingest, I have to be abreast of what's happening. And I found it hard to combine that with, you know, the pressures of day-to-day job. And so one of the things I decided is about 15 years ago, so 2007, I decided that I would be closed for the whole of January. and I would shoot off to the tropics and read 20 business books.
Nice.
And so every year I read 20 books in the tropics, actually read 30, but then I take the, that gives me the opportunity to not finish, you know, 10 of them. So a bit of a sort of Britain's Got Talent approach to it. So there's an elimination round. My list of books is on Goodreads, and by I have the discipline because I know that some of my alumni, you know, I've trained about 10,000 people now, wait for the sort of end of January release of my list. So it's nowhere near as popular as the Barack Obama reading list, but it's a kind of like, I wonder what Fred has been doing on a lounger in Sri Lanka this year.
Mm.
And it's a great way to effectively give yourself the space to really read stuff around productivity, squiggly career, lots of other things, hopefully your contribution to the world in a written format very soon again, Graham. And then read things. So at the moment, for example, in January, I was in Buenos Aires for a month, or Argentina and Uruguay, and I read lots of stuff around AI. Last year, I read a couple of stuff around, you know, Bitcoin and you create your own, you know, you stimulate your brain by hiving off moments that are entirely dedicated to growth.
Mm.
And better people than me have found ways to do that by reading a book every evening. And I know it doesn't work for me. And so in a bizarre fashion, my productivity hack is to collapse all of my growth and all of my reading into one discrete pocket, which, you know, by the time you add up all the hour here and there, you know, an hour a day, that's probably equivalent to what I do in January. But I found a way to reschedule it that way.
I mean, I actually used to do something very similar. So for a good 7-8 years in the early part of Think Productive's history, my business, and actually a little bit before that too, I would always in the winter go to Goa.
Mm-hmm.
And what a lot of people were sort of surprised about was the fact that every time I went away, I went to the same beach. I sat in the same bars, mm-hmm. you know, and it was almost like a routine thing. And people would say, well, why didn't you go somewhere else? And it's like, no, because the point is that I don't want to have to think about anything else. And I would literally take a stack of business books. This was in a few years before the Kindle came out. And then I was taking Kindle for a few years. It changed a little bit once I had a child. So mm-hmm. I think I've been twice, and he's 6. So I'm not getting that out there every year at the moment, but that would be the intention of it. I would take a big stack of business books. I'd also, sort of take my pad to do business planning and you know, idea generation and maybe write some slides and that kind of thing. But yeah, like very much a time of just no clients, no email, pretty much solitude and just doing work in the sunshine in the sort of British winter time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. That sounds fascinating. And I love your hack of just going, let me not overstimulate my explorator brain by just going to the same beach.
Yeah.
So that, you know, you get like 24 hours of real excitement of being back. And then it's kind of like, it's a bit of a routine. And then all the excitement comes from the page in front of you rather than
the
environment around you. Absolutely. I love that.
And if I look back on Think Productive, my business, you know, I can think of 3 or 4 of our best-selling workshop products were all written on basically the same 2 balconies in mm-hmm. Goa, right? Like, because it's just, you know, and just waking up really early in the morning and just being able to look out to sea and write is just, it's a really beautiful sort of, you know, wonderful way of doing it. But it sounds like you travel around a bit. So Buenos Aires and then Sri Lanka,
was the year before. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then, you know what, rebounding from the comment, one of the notions I have, and that's an interesting one, which is people are, you know, there's 4 different types of jobs. There's a product, process, performance. Well, let's go with 3, but you know, product, process, performance.
Mm.
And if you do performance, it's Usain Bolt. Effectively, your life is entirely dependent on 10 seconds every 4 years. And yes, there's a few competitions in between, but fundamentally, it's 10 seconds every 4 years. And the way you optimize to achieve that peak is very different from a job where you show up every day and you've got to do the same thing. And it's a very different. And typically, when people talk about productivity, one of the reasons I'm a little bit reticent about sort of the let's call it the the extreme form of productivity is that it applies really, really well when you're in process types of occupation. Yeah. When you're in a product, oh, sorry, I messed the 4P, product or project, which is a bit the same thing. But when you have a project, there's, you know, consulting, there's a 6 month time frame, you run quite a bit. But if you go straight into another 6 month thing where you're running the same speed, you're going to choke. Because it's not the 100 yards of 100 meters of Usain Bolt, but you have to be at a high level of concentration and performance, and then you allow yourself a break in the middle. And that's where I got this idea of, you know, going, I'm probably like you, going on the beach for a bit. If you're a process person, so you've got process, performance, project, and product, and they have slightly different rhythm, and what looks like a really smart, productive way to optimize yourself for delivery looks very different from the outside.
Yeah, okay.
When you see Usain Bolt, if you were to examine his daily routine, there's a lot of, you know, being horizontal and sleeping and lying about, which doesn't look very productive until you factor in the way in which he explodes energy and et cetera, et cetera.
Which, again, coming back to your thing of wanting to stay one step ahead, you know, in terms of that helping smart people to get smarter. You know, you need to have those breaks and that kind of break in the normal rhythm of things.
Absolutely.
Love that. It sounds like you have a skepticism around like productivity, like I was going to say media or kind of the stories that people tell each other about productivity and that whole thing. And the good news is I do too, but like, tell me more about your relationship with productivity and things that you perhaps see online that you really disagree with.
Well, sometimes refer to it as, you know, the productivity industrial complex. And sometimes, you know, Tim Ferriss and the 4-hour week, a lot of it seems to be around efficiency rather than effectiveness.
Yeah.
And so it's about the over optimization of, so for example, just very simply put, can you see that, you know, you're talking about a young child. I also sort of, you know, split up when my son was quite young and we traveled a lot together, and there's a bit where when you're trying to optimize a relationship with another human, you miss the pockets of unproductive time. And you know, and I know that that's where a lot of bonding takes place. Mm. And it's where a lot of the beauty happens. And without wanting to bring all of that to a work environment, a lot of the, and that's an interesting challenge in the COVID time, a lot of the, you know, a lot of the literature around successful organizations talk about motivated teams who feel quite strong cultural bond to one another. And if you ask where the bond took place, it was not in the shaving of seconds in the handover between tasks. It was in the slightly unproductive discussion around, or allegedly unproductive discussions around the, you know, around the water cooler or in the kitchen.
Yeah, or sharing the birthday cake or whatever.
Absolutely. And so there's a little bit around that where, you know, if you look back, if anybody, any of you, any of the listeners will think back and go, what has been the most productive thing I've ever done in my life? And sometimes, you know, in a professional context, and sometimes you might just talk to a random stranger who happened to be XYZ, and it could have been a wasted minute, and it turned out that it changed your life with a job offer and or other circumstances. And so there's a little bit about, and the way I think of it is I think of it as a productivity budget, which is I sponsor my serendipitous productivity by extracting budget from my efficiency productivity. So There are bits where I go, I'm going to be super efficient. I'm going to, you know, write these this chapter of the book. I'm going to give myself 6 hours and it's going to be done. And I have to do X thousand words and I'm going to be super productive. And at the end of that, I'm going to give myself a couple of hours of serendipitous time. And it's that. And again, you recognize possibly the roller coaster of strategic thinking, which is you do better by combining two extremes of heat and cold rather than having something tepidish. So be ruthlessly productive in areas where it matters, but allow yourself to be sort of ruthlessly serendipitous, if it's not a contradiction in term, in areas where you want to create, you know. And for you, by the sound of it, it might be go on a walk. You know, if we come back all the way to the beginning, you were saying That's where sometimes you refresh your brain. For me, one of the ways to refresh my brain is literally to pick a book on a subject that has nothing to do with what currently occupies me.
Nice. And what's also interesting is that often if you do that, you'll find some interesting connections, and like that serendipity will come in all kinds of different forms that may well even inform the work, help the work, and so on, right? Like, I think there's, one of my ninja characteristics of in Productivity Ninja is all about unorthodoxy and just kind of taking inspiration from really unusual places. I think it's often it's too boring and predictable to only sort of read on your own subject matter or only take the advice of Steve Jobs and Richard Branson and the kind of known names, so to speak.
Yep, very much so.
Yeah, that really resonates with me, that whole ruthless serendipity thing. The other thing that it sort of springs to mind for me is I talk a lot about a productivity ninja being a human and not a superhero, because it really bugs me, the whole like let's try and optimize everything kind of mentality. I think sometimes people feel like that's how I want the world to be too. I just think those richer experiences around the fringes of things are often where a lot more of the excitement is.
Indeed, in particular, when the world changes, and when the world changes, and people talk about sort of the power of habits. Habits are fantastic if nothing changes around you. If lots of things are changing around you, whether personally or professionally or in the wider environment, then clearly you don't know what the next best solution is going to be, and the way to discover that is through discovery, and the best way to discover is, there's a school of thought that goes, test and learn, and I would plug onto that a little bit upstream the idea of have as many ideas as you can. And before you test and learn them, then you kind of pare them down to a reasonable amount, but have lots of, and so there is effectively efficiency or habit is a downstream concern when the world is still unknown. When the world is well known, it's perfectly fine to find ways to, on your journey to work when it's the same commute, to find ways to take this street rather than that street, to shave a few seconds skipping that traffic light. When you find a situation where you have to completely reinvent what the definition of going to work means, then what you're better off is coming up with lots of alternative options rather than try to optimize the one that you just happen to have settled upon, which we haven't really touched upon, which is the big, big, big unsaid in that, which is personality types, which is people have different, have default preferences. And I'm going to throw my son in it in his absence. Sorry, Louis. But so his mom and I have a possibly default preference for things being on the spontaneous end of the spectrum rather than the organized end of the spectrum. And when Louis was younger, he was very much on the, I prefer things organized. And then, as a parent, as a responsible stakeholder, or as a responsible adult, you can either, a lot of people kind of force their children to adjust to their cultural preferences, whether, political, cultural, etc. Or you kind of go, a happy line is a perfect example of a happy line. And then one of the solutions we both discovered with Louis is when you would say, what's the plan this weekend? Every other weekend, we would have created a little plan because, that makes him happy. And then every other weekend, when we didn't have a plan, instead of telling him, we're just going to chill, we would say things like, the plan is to chill. And and all of a sudden, the plan was to chill, which is a perfectly acceptable plan for him.
Yeah.
And sort of in his mental diaries, he would like put a line through Saturday and Sunday and write chill, at which point there's a plan. We're not just, and so personality types come into the equation when it comes to, how do you make, how do you make a cat very productive as opposed to how you make a dog very productive? Dogs, you can train them and they love a bit of productivity. Cats, it's a nightmare. Herding cat is an expression for a reason. And it's a bit the same thing with, if I bring it back, if I combine sort of the productivity ninja with the strategic thing, how to be strategic and the roller coaster, is in the roller coaster, most people are good at one bit of the journey, but not the others. And so some people are very good at being very creative up front, but then they get a bit too subjective and enamored of their solution even when they're not very practical. On the other hand, you have people who might be very good, the person I described might be a bit tiggerish. You have Eeyores who are really good at finding the flow in everything, but left unattended, their world is not going to change much. And so there's a bit where to become a better strategist or a more productive ninja, you probably have to embrace your dark side, embrace the bit that doesn't come very naturally to you. And time and time again, there's only two ways to really achieve that, is either, you grow to become able to do the bit that doesn't come naturally to you, or you find, in life or at work, a partner who compensates your strength with their strength.
And this feels like such a lovely conclusion and way to finish the conversation, because I often get asked, because I've done about 100 hours of podcasts now, and, typically with people who've written books, CEOs, high achievers, creative people, and I'm often asked, what's the lesson and the through line and the thread line through all of these people? And, what can we learn about high achievement through this? And I always just say, I've only learned one thing, and it's this, just that humans are weird, right? Like, we're all weird, we're all different. And actually a lot of the richness comes from, like you say, embracing that dark side and kind of recognizing that other people will be really different to you in the way that they work. And that's how you grow and sort of get somewhere better, together with them.
Absolutely. And, there's no such queer as folks, and the journey never ends. We discover more quirks every time about ourselves and about others.
I've loved this conversation, and it's been a lot more philosophical than I was expecting a conversation about how to be strategic to be. So I just want to say thank you so much for being on Beyond Busy, Fred. And where can people find out more about you, and where can they get the book, and just tell us what you want to plug at the end here?
Yeah, so the book is in every good bookshop. How to Be Strategic, coming out digital, physical, and audio on the 8th of October. And then for more things about me, it's fredpelard.com, FREDPELARD.com.
Thanks so much for being on Beyond Busy.
My pleasure. It was lovely. Thank you, Graham.
So there you go. Thanks to Fred for being on the show. Thanks also, as ever, to Think Productive, our sponsors for the show. If you're interested in productivity training and coaching, then go to thinkproductive.com. Thanks also to Mark Stedman, my producer, and to Emily for helping to put all this together. We have been doing a lot of work on the graymalcott.com website and on lots of other marketing-related stuff. So kind of looking forward to the next few weeks of really kicking a lot of my marketing stuff into gear. It's been like my New Year's resolution really for 2020, and got a little bit derailed at points in the year with, being basically like full-time on the dad stuff a lot of days. But really a lot of stuff happening behind the scenes, and looking forward to sharing that with you in the next few weeks. So check out what's been changing at graymalcott.com. And also you can always find out what I'm doing with the graymalcott.com/now. This is an idea from Derek Sivers, and I put this in my email signature, but it's also available just on the graymalcott.com site. So if you're ever curious, like, what's Graham working on, just graymalcott.com/now. And I'd really recommend you doing the same thing, like having your own now page. It's a really cool little thing. So there you go. That's my little closing ramble. So we'll be back in a week's time with another episode. So until then, wherever you are, stay safe. Take care. Bye for now.